Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your problematic bisexual anthem of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Karen Gans. What we were just listening to is a song that came out a few days ago, although now it feels like perhaps a year. It's called Girls, and the main artist on it is Rita Ora. And it's also featuring Bebe Rexha, Charlie XCX, and Cardi B. And I have assembled a panel of experts here to discuss it because the song kicked up a little bit of a brouhaha within the first 24 hours of its arrival. So on my left, we have Wesley Morris, who is a critic at large at the New York Times Magazine and the Culture Department.
Hi, everybody.
What's up, Wesley?
What's not up?
We will get there. On my right, I have Mackenzie Scott, who performs as Torres.
Hello.
And on the phone calling in from London, we have the pop artist and songwriter, Shura.
Hello there.
So I'm going to give a little brief background for our listeners who might not know what happened with Girls, and then we can just sort of dive on into it. But basically, the song arrived and was touted as a bisexual anthem. And Rita Ora didn't necessarily say those words until she was asked them by a magazine. They said, "Do you consider this a bisexual anthem?" And she said, "Absolutely." And she was sort of inching her way out of the closet as a bisexual. And I think everybody thought that the song was going to be beloved. Well, everybody who made it, the social media surrounding it was very excited. And then very quickly, people started listening to the lyrics and they had a different reaction. And within 3 days, Rita Ora had to walk the song back in a sort of apology. Cardi B came out kind of defending it a little bit. And the reason for the brouhaha was that the lyrics seemed, while they were, yes, celebrating same-sex love, it was a little bit filtered through a male gaze, kind of like, I get drunk and I want to kiss girls, not necessarily I am who I am, so I want to kiss girls. So if everybody has any opinions on what was problematic or a lyric that struck them as particularly an issue, let's go around and do that.
I would say all of it. I mean, but, you know, it's interesting because it is, at the same time, it is the perpetuation of a long-standing problem, which is, I guess, one of the things we're going to talk about. But it didn't strike me as unusually offensive. I can just understand why people are mad at the song. And it is just, like, it is just perpetuating. It is another perpetuation from at least one or two people that you would expect to maybe be thinking differently about the expression of these feelings. And it also, I mean, without identifying any particular lyric that is a problem, it just feels like a bandwagon, like an identity bandwagon anthem, more than it is like a anthem of bisexuality. It's more like one night stand same sex opportunism more than anything else. But so all the lyrics.
Well, you know, I should have pointed this out, but some of the critics that came out against the song immediately were queer artists, so including Hayley Kiyoko and Kalani, who said, every so often there come certain songs with messaging that's just downright tone deaf, which does more harm than good for the LGBTQ plus community. A song like this just fuels the male gaze while marginalizing the idea of women, I believe it's loving women. my printout cutout. And Kalani said that there were harmful lyrics, period, even though she like praised the artist and she said that she's worked with them. Shura, you were one of the first people to actually tweet out the list of people who had written on the song, which I think struck a nerve with some people. Do you want to talk about that?
What I think is interesting is that in isolation, none of the lyrics, as Wesley pointed out, are especially offensive, but it's very difficult to take lyrics in isolation because they comprise an entire song. And when you have so many things that tick the boxes of things that we're used to hearing with regard to kind of, men finding women, loving women, titillating or, you know, sexually appealing, I think then it's sort of, it can sort of become a problem, even if the intention isn't there to sort of proliferate that idea. I think a lot of people have picked up on kind of the wine lyric and gone, okay, well, it's a song about getting drunk and kissing a girl in the same way that I kissed a girl is. And actually, it's not. It's not the same as that, because mm-hmm. the opening verse is kind of unambiguously stating her sexuality. Unfortunately, in the press sort of surrounding the release of the song, she was much more ambiguous. So it's kind of, I think, the lyrics themselves aren't, as I said, especially offensive, but everything sort of surrounding how it's been released and the kind of not wanting to offend or alienate a specific audience has sort of meant that in doing so, she's kind of offended everyone a little bit and sort of walking back the idea of it being a bisexual anthem by saying, because what she actually said is, absolutely, I want it to be a bisexual anthem, but I want it to feel like it's an anthem to somebody, which is the most non-committal sort of statement you can make. And then at the end she says, so I'll take it. So it's kind of being like, oh, if people say that, then I'll accept it. But it's not claiming it for herself. And I do think the question's actually unfair. I think to ask someone if something's an anthem, to ask any artist if something is an anthem, is it's not for them to decide. No one should ever set out to write something that they think is going to be an anthem for people. That's something for the audience to decide. And as we've discovered, the audience has very much decided that it doesn't represent them, or at least a portion of the audience has decided it doesn't represent them.
Definitely. That's funny. We actually have an interview with Stephen Malkmus coming out on Sunday. And one of the questions was, who gets to decide what a song is about, the artist or the listener? And he was like, absolutely the listener.
I think it's interesting. You know, the wine lyric, yes, that is the lyric that so many people have latched onto. And I think it was Haley who said, I believe I saw that she tweeted, I don't need wine to love girls. I just love girls. I do think it's interesting that, you know, a decade after Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl, you know, one woman kissing another woman, we're blaming it on alcohol. And it positions this act as something that's kind of, it's risque.
Mm-hmm.
It's, mm-hmm. And it also automatically assumes heteronormativity because, you know, the lyric is, what is it? I'm 50-50, something mm-hmm. like that. But it, in the same breath, she's basically saying, you know, the naughty thing is for me to kiss a girl after I have some wine. That doesn't make you 50-50. If you're right. if you're positioning this as an act that totally. Is only acceptable after a few drinks and something that you only want to do one night, you're not 50-50.
Yeah, tell me what you do on a Tuesday.
She also prefaces that statement, the 50-50, with the phrase open-minded, which is, I think, interesting because it's lazy, and I know it doesn't probably mean this, but it also sort of says that anyone who isn't 50-50 or isn't okay snogging a woman or a man or someone of the same sex is a prude in some way, which is also kind of weird.
Yeah, I don't think, like, as the person owning the identity or inhabiting the identity or by whom the identity is inhabited, that doesn't make you open-minded. That makes you it.
Yeah.
Well, think about how much more powerful the song would have been if she had simply written a song and used female pronouns.
Well, but she didn't write the song. That's the thing. The men who wrote this song are quote, open-minded, unquote.
Okay, that's
They're
a good
open-minded
point.
For the thing that men have always been, like straight men have always been open-minded for, which is to watch two girls make out.
Yeah.
And in this case, they got four. It's just,
We're super open-minded about group sex.
Totally. To be fair, Rita has a writing credit, as does Cardi, as does the person who is sort of widely known as one of Cardi's ghostwriters. And then I think there's like five or six other songwriters, one of whom is a woman. But yes.
It took 50 people to write this song, by the way.
I encourage you to watch our video series, Diary of a Song, Wesley, where we explain how many people it took to write the middle. Because, you know,
that makes sense. It's a great song.
That is a great song. but, you know, keep in mind, there's like people who like, you know, all the producers and the, you know,
listen,
the
dribs
and the drabs,
you,
the pop music machine.
And yet.
And yet. I am not here to defend the song.
Well, it is. It does sound good. You know, the thing that is sort of annoying about this is that, you know, as a person who is hunting for things to identify as things I'm going to be stuck with all summer, I actually am curious about how long this song's legs are going to turn out to be.
Wesley, this song is canceled. I don't think this song is going. I think when your two of your artists have to like make statements about it within 72 hours of release, I don't really see it getting pushed to radio. And I think the faith in the song is gone. I mean, Charlie was
you're right
Instagramming sure. about this, and it has ceased. Which is funny because when I first heard the song, I was like, wow, this isn't the kind of banger that I expected it to be. But while preparing for the podcast, I listened to it a few more times. I have to admit that it is now stuck in my head. And I don't know if that's good or bad.
But I think if you listen to anything enough times, elements of it are going to get stuck in your head, especially something that's intended to be, you know, it sounds very much like a nursery rhyme or a football chant. Mm-hmm. The chorus, I can imagine, you know, 30,000 drunken men in a football stadium singing it.
I think I just covered my genitals. I just covered my genitals.
Not all men, Wesley. Well, why do we think, I think we've all sort of like hinted at this, but why, I mean, I have my own reasons for this, but why do we think that Katy Perry's song got a pass 10 years ago in a way that this song didn't? I think there are reasons about the messages.
I think they're really different songs.
Yeah, they are different songs, the quality of the song, the message of the song, but also obviously the time we're in, social media, sort of like a moment where people are not afraid to express outrage. When I first saw the apologies walking the song back, I was like, what could be more 2018 than somebody having to walk something back, you know, almost immediately after doing it?
It's interesting because, first of all, the Katy Perry song as a song is just a better song. If the first single off the post-Witness Katy Perry album was I Kissed a Girl, she'd be canceled too. So I think the time has changed, even if that song were exactly the same and sounded as good as it did 10 years ago. But I also think the reason, and people grumbled about it, people grumbled about that song too.
I hated it when it came out.
But, you know, there's something about the story that song is telling, and it isn't, this song is a, like, Girls is a sloshy, it is a drunken song. And there's something, you know, I heard I Kissed a Girl, and I actually thought about Jill Sobule's I Kissed a Girl. And the way, and for anybody, I mean, should we play some of Jill Sobule's I Kissed a Girl?
Oh my God, absolutely. Let's do that right now.
Jenny came over and told me about Fred. He's such a hairy behemoth, she said. Dumb as a box of hammers, but he's such a handsome guy. And I opened up and I told her about Larry. And yesterday how he asked me to marry. And I'm not giving him an answer yet. I think I can do better. So we left. Compared notes. We had a drink, we had a smoke. She took off her overcoat. I kissed a girl. She called home to say she'd be late. He said he worried, but now he feels safe.
I don't know. For anybody who doesn't, like, remember that song, it was a sweet song about a woman who, I mean, it really was an experiment, and she wasn't drunk when she did it, and she was attracted to this woman. And that is an element of how certain bisexuality works. And I don't know what there's, I mean, I guess there's also an element of how bisexuality works with this Katy Perry song. It's very Spring Break in its appreciation of that kind of same-sex experience. But I don't know, it kind of aligns.
Well, she also doesn't, in the opening verse, state her sexuality. You know, she just sort of says, you know, I didn't plan to do that. I was a bit drunk and this seemed like a fun idea. Whereas Girls starts with, hi, I'm bisexual, which I think makes the two songs different. And I mean, I've been speaking so much to so many different queer musicians that I know. And I was speaking yesterday with Katie from Luna, and we were talking about what pushes the envelope with pop. When Katy Perry wrote this song, she had to convince her record label to put this song out. Her record label said, we cannot release this. It will not get played at radio. The Bible Belt will not get it. It's not going to be a hit. And eventually she convinced them to. I don't suspect for a moment that any of those conversations were happening at Atlantic. I don't suppose for a moment anyone had to convince a label exec that we should do this. It's going to be a big moment. And I obviously don't know the conversations that happen behind closed doors with regard to this song, but I can imagine label execs getting incredibly excited of the idea of four beautiful women singing about kissing each other when they're drunk, irrespective of whether or not it's, you know, I'm a bisexual or I just do it when I'm drunk. I mean, I can see them imagining the video already, you know, going, let's just get all of them in a room and have a green screen and snog. And if that's what the video was,
point.
I'm sure they're canning it right now.
It's a great point.
But in terms of pushing the envelope in pop music, one of the observations that Katie made was that if a woman is singing about a man in a song, there should be a chance of the man being able to have sex in the song. And that's not new, and it appears actually in Girls. And what's interesting is that we have a hit, and this is not a queer hit, but we have a hit like New Rules by Dua Lipa, where it's about a man absolutely not getting any sex. And maybe that's our new pushing the envelope. Maybe just being queer or just being bisexual is no longer sort of brave. Obviously coming out and being comfortable in your sexuality is brave, but the song itself and releasing it isn't just because it contains that is no longer kind of a huge deal anymore, or it shouldn't be.
Totally. That's a really great point. I feel like you had something to say about I Kissed a Girl.
Well, yeah, if it's okay for me to bring it back to Katy Perry.
Always.
Yeah. You know, when that song came out, I loved it a lot. But I will say that it still, at that moment and still a decade later, I find that song to be problematic in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm recalling the lyric. She says, I hope my boyfriend don't mind it, which, you know, okay, so she's cheating, but she's also kind of saying, but maybe he won't mind it because this is not a valid experience. Like,
oh, that's interesting.
You know what
I
mean?
I heard the cheating part.
Like, maybe he won't mind it because it doesn't count if it's a woman.
Or maybe he'll also mind it is a kind of cheeky nod to he might also enjoy it.
Right. Mm-hmm. As well as the following lyric, which says, it felt so wrong. It felt so right. Don't mean I'm in love tonight. So I still find that to be really irritating. Even though I love the song, I'll still sing it at the top of my lungs. Mm-hmm. But I find it to be very grating. And it's like, even now I'm like, gosh, don't do me any favors, you know? I really like, what if I don't want that? What if I don't want to kiss you?
I'm curious for you, God, my-
think about it from the perspective of the queer person she's kissing, who's now trapped in the endless loop of kissing straight women who don't actually want to be in relationships with them.
We're
having a kumbaya moment here, guys. I will say, though, to Katy Perry's credit, that she was recently asked about the song and said that through a 2018 lens, through the experiences she's had in the past 10 years, she would change the lyrics.
Yeah, what would she change? Did she say?
She wasn't specific.
She didn't say no, but she did imply
she'd have to change a lot of the song, right?
It felt so right, maybe.
Yeah,
it only felt right.
But, you know, the difference...
So good. It felt so right. There you go, done.
We have a couple of songwriters here. We could just whip this up by the end of this.
Amen. But I will say the other thing about I Kissed a Girl that's really important is the performance. I remember the resistance I had to that song having everything to do with the moment I actually heard it. And a lot of hearing it for me was believing the woman singing it was having this experience, right? Hmm. And so there is a conflict that is inside Katy Perry and not, to me, in a writer's room. She is performing the pleasure of having done it, the conflict of having done it, and the endorsement of the lifestyle of people who do it all the time. And all of that is coming from her singing. And I felt like it was more okay to enjoy the experience of liking that song because I believed the experience of the person delivering it to me, despite the problem that you have, you know, if you lay the lyrics. I mean, this is pop songwriting 101. Like, you'll believe anything a good song tells you is happening. And the problem with girls is I don't believe anybody in this song.
It's funny that
I think to be able to have a meaningful discussion about the song and the reaction to it, we have to at least sort of accept that what Rita Ora is saying about her sexuality in the opening lyric is true, because otherwise we sort of get into a rabbit hole of, do I believe she's bi or whatever? Like, to have a meaningful discussion, you have to go, okay, well, there's a kernel of truth here. And I think, in sort of to support what you're saying, you do really believe Katy Perry, but there were four songwriters on that, and two of them are women. One of them was Kathy Dennis,
damn,
who, Toxic, here we go, brilliant songwriter. With this one, with girls you have nine, six of whom are men, and I think King Princess put it really well. The issue with working with cis men, like having cis men in a studio writing with women, especially queer women, is when it no longer is a collaboration and there's a hierarchy, and then a queer woman has to sort of aimlessly front what it is a man has written. And she hasn't said this about this song in particular, but just that's sort of a concern. And I think, you know, I mentioned it, I've talked to you about it, Karen.
Yes.
But the having cis men, so many at that level, at the upper echelon of kind of pop writing, is that you have kind of so in this instance, we, you know, it's possible that we have a queer woman who had, you know, whose lived experience, her truth, is sort of in danger or at risk of being sort of massaged into what is an imagined idea of what their experience was by straight men. And the problem is imagination is prone to fantasy, and what is true about straight men, not all straight men, is that the idea of two women together is appealing, is titillating. So I'm not saying that's definitely what's happened here, but it's very difficult not to feel that way listening to it.
It also struck me that Rita was sort of trying to inoculate herself to the criticism by coming out, sort of, you know, being like, I'm Jewish, so I can make Jewish jokes.
My least favorite move, yeah. Right? Just be, I mean, I guess it's in the song too. But yeah. I mean, sure, you had mentioned earlier that you'd mentioned the act of coming out as being a brave act, which no one is arguing against, right? But this song isn't brave in a lot of ways because she's relying, and it's not, the thing that would have been interesting to me in this song is if it was Rita Ora saying, hey, I want to write a song about being bisexual. And I would love to have some of my favorite female artists come and support me on this journey. And instead, you get basically what is essentially a party song that conforms to the worst stereotypes of what men think they want women to do. With I don't know. I feel like the bravery ends after like the first couplet, basically. It's over.
After Kush Lovin'.
Yeah.
But interestingly, in the radio edit, Kush Lovin' has been changed to Hush Lovin', which is just another kind of...
Wow.
It's making it, you know, radio-friendly because we're not referencing rolling a joint and smoking it in a 68 Chevy or whatever it is. It's saying, oh, but, you know, this is going to be our secret. Which, again, which is why I say, in isolation, none of these lyrics, they're not great, but none of them are, you know, that problematic. But when you take everything and then you consider how they edited it for radio to be then, oh, this secretive thing, you just think, no one here has thought about this for more than 5 minutes, and the song has been in existence for 2 years. What they've been worrying about is not, you know, how can we best represent Rita's truth. They've been worrying about who can we get on this record that I'm mates with, or who can we get on this record that's going to move the dial at, you know, at radio or with sales. It's like everyone here has been worrying about the wrong things, and there's so much thoughtlessness. I think thoughtlessness is sort of my. I think I've said that so many times.
That's your watchword for this song. Yeah.
Thoughtless. It feels thoughtless.
Well, considering that both you and Mackenzie, we have two artists here who do make thoughtful music from a gay perspective, I was wondering if either of you wanted to talk about your experiences recording your music or writing, or if you ever were conflicted about saying anything or any reaction you've received.
You know, if you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I probably would have said absolutely yes. But I would have said so more out of fear of, you know, relatives, you know, becoming aware of my sexuality, and less, it would have been less about, you know, public perception. That being said, you know, I can only write from my perspective. So it's hard to be conflicted about something when I don't know any other feeling.
I mean, I guess the conflict will only come from like the fear of revealing something to, you know, a specific audience that might not receive it the way you wanted. Yeah.
Sure. At least in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, I think that there has been a lot of change, as we said before, since the Katy Perry phenomenon and all of that passed. I think even more recently, we've seen a lot of queer women just writing openly about loving women. I think that we've entered a new era of actually having that be really cool. Like, I don't want to say that there has been a lesbian trend per se, but I have noticed both professionally in the songwriting world, as well as just personally in my own day to day, that it has become somewhat fashionable. And I don't want to invalidate, you know, any experience of someone who is actually a woman-loving woman, but it has become quite fashionable to say, well, I'm like 80% lesbian. Like I've heard a lot of people
that's
say
a
that.
Lot of lesbian.
Yeah, that's more
like they put a
that's
percentage.
More than 50-50.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people do that kind of thing where they're like, yeah, I'm pretty gay. And I think that it's become kind of not only acceptable, but kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And I might be wrong about that. That's my perspective.
It still feels, though, like these songs are such outliers to the fact that people discuss it as like, oh, the lesbian song on the album, like the Halsey duet with Lauren from Fifth Harmony.
The lesbian song.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely have that experience without all the disclaimer. Just Michelle and DeGioia's new album, super lesbian. And, you know, sort of gender non-binary in a lot of ways, too, in the way she covers these songs. It's called Ventriloquism, by the way. It's great. I don't know. It just, like, on the one hand, this has always been here, right? So when you enter the realm of pop music, it actually is non-existent. And you really are talking about I Kissed a Girl, like Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl, and then this.
In terms of scale, yeah, friends of the podcast, Tegan and Sarah, obviously,
right.
Have been here for a
right.
long
yes,
time.
Yes, that's
but,
true.
Yeah.
That's true. But I mean, in terms of scale, Tegan and Sarah obviously have carried a lot of water.
Yeah.
In terms of like writing great pop songs about themselves that are like unambiguous in terms of their what they're about.
I think that queer desire in popular music, especially popular music, is still something that we're sort of wrestling with. And, you know, I personally, on my record, I don't know whether I did this on purpose or kind of without thinking, but avoided gender pronouns. And partly because I think, I was talking to my girlfriend about it, growing up, we would, as queer women, swap pronouns anyway in straight songs. We would imagine them to be she if it were he. So we're so used to that. But whether the heterosexual population is as well equipped to reprogram pronouns as we are, I'm not sure. And I think that I read that piece in the MIT about K.D. Lang, and there was this really interesting comment about Ellen DeGeneres and how her popularity was as a result of her being kind of affable and not to be really perceived. She wasn't perceived as an erotic threat, and I think that's still very true in how queer desire is represented in popular music. You know, for instance, my record was very much about sort of unrequited love and not being successful and being a goofball. You know, I did not present as an erotic threat. Even with artists like Troye Sivan, who deals in pronouns and then talks about gay sex, you know, relatively explicitly, it still doesn't feel, you know, he's not singing directly, as far as I'm aware, about penetrating someone because that's he's talking about being, you know, passive in his relationships, and I wonder, you know, how would we feel about, you know, a woman singing about, I don't know, it feels as if everyone that we see, it's still not, we're not really perceived as erotic threats, and that's where the heterosexual community wants to, not maybe not wants to keep us, but that's their comfort level. And a song like Girls is absolutely, you know, no one here is really an erotic threat because everyone's a bit tipsy and, you know, just smoked a joint and is having fun.
Wesley lit up when you said not an erotic threat.
About Katie Lang. No, well, no, it's just more like this. I am obsessed with the concept of what an erotic threat even is, right? This is not about anything we're necessarily directly talking about, but it's just the culture of how we deem a successful portrayal of, or like what it is that queer people want when we see ourselves represented in some space. And I do think it's really fascinating that one of the things you want to see, like a sort of normalized portrayal of some version of gay life. It's also like sex is that in some way, part of it is sex that convinces you is real and the kind of sex you might experience in your real life. And I think there is a resistance against passivity, but there also is this awareness that there's a line in terms of who gets, like, the term threat. I always go back to like something like the way Sharon Stone functions in Basic Instinct. Do you know what I mean? And the way
we all do.
But that was presented in the com- the contempt for how she functioned in that movie as being an erotic threat, which, of course, in the narrative of itself, she's supposed to be. But the sort of political problem with how Sharon Stone functions in that movie is as an erotic threat. You know, both women in that movie are presented as erotic threats. And that's obviously politically problematic. And it's a hard thing to get around because is there a positive version of an erotic threat? This is such a tangent.
One of them is an erotic threat a man can definitely have sex with still. He just might end up dead as a result.
Right.
But here's a question. I was struck by what you just said about wanting to see a representation of queer sexuality that rings true. Do we really believe that, like, the straight sexuality in our pop music rings true to anyone?
Or is that's the other thing. That's a really great question.
I think it should be dismantled and we should start again, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, with kids growing up and they watch, you know, portrayals of relationships and love on television and in movies and in pop songs, like, that's not a very realistic depiction of what things are actually like. So I guess in that sense, Girls isn't that different than a straight pop song in that the experience is just as false.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really smart.
But you do get a song like Blurred Lines, you know, and Robin Thicke does really suffer, and not just because he ripped off Marvin Gaye. You know, you have very, very problematic lyrics, you know, wanting to domesticate a woman because she's an animal, or, you know, and then a man liberating her and you have the same lyrics more or less word for word in Girls. You I tamed it, you
I'm
know,
pray and
tail.
Kill and yep.
I put the lion in the cage, and you know, so the lion is the tattoo on Cara Delevingne's finger, or whatever it is that the son explained it as, but it, you know, I'm the hunter and she the prey. Yeah, I'm the thriller, I'm the killer, I'm the savior. I mean, this is just, it's not
Who
how we
thinks
should...
of sex that way? Under what circumstances?
I'd love for you to not kill me, thank you. That's not really what I'm after tonight.
One request.
Please. Everybody get up.
Talking to Katie from Muna, and she was saying that there is this sort of, you know, obsession of in culture, music, of man sees woman, wants to possess and destroy. And I think that's a really interesting problem we have with how we look at sex. And I don't think it's unrelated to what we've seen in the last year or so with how, you know, men and women behave. And just because that's with each other, but just because we're seeing it, you know, right up front and center with how men have treated women particularly, doesn't mean that we shouldn't also be looking at it in the LGBT world. I don't feel like I could get away with saying that just because I'm a girl and not a guy. I think we sort of mysticized female sexuality and male sexuality into this thing where they're so different, and maybe they're not, and therefore we just need to re-look at it again and stop thinking about it as someone you want to sleep with being, you know, someone you want to domesticate or possess or destroy. It's bizarre.
Well, I was going to say, not that Blurred Lines was a great song. I mean, the goodness of it came from what was likely stolen from Marvin Gaye.
Likely.
But okay, it did. But it came in such an appealing package that I think that it got away with months and months and months of people just sort of mindlessly singing along to it. I know I was actually a victim of that.
We were all guilty.
Yeah, I did it at karaoke, and a friend from another music magazine was like, how can you possibly sing that song? And I stopped for 5 seconds and thought about it, and it was like I had awakened from, you know, a slumber. I was like, oh my God, this song is problematic. But it took almost a year, I think, for it to get called out.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that Fifth Harmony Work From Home was really weird.
Oh, yeah.
And written by people who were involved in the song Girls also. I mean, it sounds really fun. It's got a great hook. The video is incredibly tongue-in-cheek. You sit down and you read the lyrics, and yes, of course, it's, you know, painted as a kind of fantasy, but if you look at it, it's like, there are children singing this song. I worry about nothing. I am wearing a nada. I'm sitting pretty impatient, but I know you gotta put in them hours. I'ma make it harder. I'm sending pic after picture. I'ma get you fired. I know you're always on that night shift, but I can't stand these nights alone. And I don't need no explanation, 'cause baby, you're the boss at home. You don't gotta go to work, 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 but you gotta go to work, 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 work. You don't gotta go to work, 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 work. Let my body do the work, 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 work. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh, oh. We can work tomorrow, oh, oh, oh. Let's put it in a motion. I was a child listening to pop music, not thinking about what I was singing. You know, I sang To Become One, not realizing it was about sex, and then finding out and being horrified. You know, we just sing along. And
Sugar Walls. Sugar Walls was mine. I really didn't know. I tell this story all the time. It is the number one song where I'm just like, you mean the walls aren't made of, we're not talking about an actual, like, I understand.
I think mine was Ignition. Is that you know, seven years old, something like that.
That song is quintuple canceled now.
Oh my God. But as you know, a 7, 8 year old.
Just turn the key.
Yeah, it's just about driving. I'd love to drive a car.
I haven't thought about this in years. And I went to the Z100 Jingle Ball this year with our chief pop critic, John Pareles, who was reviewing it. And I just could not get over. I mean, it made me feel like the oldest person in the world. How horrified I was at what everybody was parroting back, and also what people were wearing. It made me imagine what all of our mothers must have thought when we were 13.
Yeah.
Well, not me. Thanks, Mom. But everybody else when they were 13 and their parents were like, you cannot go out looking like that. I was like, when does this shift? But this makes me think that it never really changes. We were talking about the topic of pop songs being about like possession to the point of smothering, ownership, killing. That's kind of been the theme of pop music since the 50s when it all started. But you would think that in a moment of more awakenedness that we're in right now, that these things would be more front of mind, which is, again, why something like this is surprising. But then you think about that study that came out around the time of the Grammys about what tiny percentage of women are involved in the making of all kinds of pop music, but particularly in songwriting and production, which were the numbers were in the single digits. And it kind of gives you a little bit more of an explanation for where we are. I mean, until more women and more queer people are in positions of power, I think we might have a lot more girls.
We have to step up, don't we?
Yeah, it's all on you and Mackenzie here, guys. Sometimes I'm mystery, sometimes I'm free, depending on my mood, on my attitude. Sometimes I want to roll, or stay at home, walk in contradiction, get some factual and fiction. A little crazy, little sexy, little cool, little rough around the edges, but I keep it smooth. I'm always left to center, and it's right where I belong. I'm the random minor, don't you hear a major song? And I like that.
ask a question? How do you guys feel about not so much Dirty Computer as an album, but about Janelle Monáe's relationship to the disclosure of her sexuality and the conversation around that disclosure, and whether or not you think the album is a successful representation of that or needs to be?
I have a lot to say about this, but I'm going to let everybody else talk first.
I personally have been waiting for this moment from Janelle Monáe for several years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been waiting and waiting. And
because she was triggering something for you?
I'm perceptive. I saw it coming and I was hoping that it was coming, and I'm so glad that it did. And I mean, you said, you know, you're not necessarily asking about the album as a whole, but in the interviews that I read from her regarding the new album, I understood what she, I mean, I think that I understand where she's coming from. I think that a lot of her hesitation surrounding this very personal statement that she's made tied in a lot to family and her personal life. And, you know, it, from what I understand, I think it seems like the persona that she carried all those years was very much kind of a protection from letting family down,
mm-hmm.
or letting down people that she was afraid to disappoint. I'm not really sure. I mean, that's the way that I'm understanding it. But yeah, I mean, I guess all I'm trying to say is that I love the album.
I would never, you know, harshly criticize somebody for their method of coming out. But my 2 points would be that there were probably times that were more important to her personally and to the community than as a marketing tactic for an album cycle. Mm-hmm. That definitely rubbed me the wrong way. And I felt like the hints over the past few years, especially in the lead up to this album, when I think she was probably planning on coming out, were like tantalizing to the point of being sort of, I don't want to say offensive.
Maybe parodic.
Yeah. But I was really rubbed the wrong way by the means of coming out.
She's complicated, obviously. And I felt like, you know, the thing that McKinsey is pointing out as being a source of frustration in the signaling she was doing, I was kind of content with what seemed to me a very obvious persona against having to deal with all of this other stuff. And then at the same time, the way it sort of manifested itself in the albums was somewhat classic. There is a mode of music that this fits into, right? And it is very much on the timeline that brings you somewhere from, you know, the 1970s and Parliament and Funkadelic to Roger and Zapp. Right, where there is this sort of machine-oriented, sort of robot-minded relationship between you, maybe your sexuality, and definitely your blackness. And I felt like this Cindy robot, the world that she had built was definitely designed to tell a story about what story she wouldn't be telling you. And so I am excited to the way she sort of didn't deconstruct that. She just kind of leapt over. She stopped being coy, but then it was similar to Rita Ora in a lot of ways, where like the language, she didn't have the language to do this thing that clearly meant a lot to her. I don't know about whether this meant a lot to Rita Ora, but it clearly meant a lot to Janelle Monáe. And I still feel like she is working through this stuff, and it'll be really interesting to hear the next album, the one that has where the pressure is different,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and she doesn't feel like she's carrying the weight of the world, even as she's trying to unburden herself of that weight.
Yeah, I think unburdening is sort of interesting in relation to Rita Ora and some of the way she's dealt with the kind of backlashes in her apology. I think she said something to the effect of hoping that my art will empower fans to feel as proud of themselves as I am learning to feel about myself, there's something about that that feels, obviously I'm not trying to negate the fact that coming out was difficult for her, but at the same time, or that coming to terms with her sexuality was difficult, you know, even, you know, I I struggled when in the beginning, being like, am I gay if I still fancy Rachel Lee Cook after the fifth run of She's All That, though I probably am. But there's something about using that in a statement in which you're supposed to apologize that feels very much as if she's using her sexuality as a shield. I think that can be problematic, because the thing is that just because you belong to a community doesn't mean that you can't do damage to that community with the way in which you present it. I can't speak to Janelle Monáe and the way that was rolled out. I'm familiar with the record. I've obviously seen many good things said about it, but I do think that thing of using your sexuality as a shield is problematic for me. You know, even though this has been a complete mess and a disaster, like, we are at a, you know, very exciting time in terms of representation as queer artists in music. And King Princess put it really well. She said that, you know, it's like an open highway. Everyone has their own lane. You know, we used to be a side road, and now there's this enormous gay highway, and there's room for everyone. And you know, the message coming from a pop behemoth does not diminish or necessarily negate, you know, me driving at 30 miles an hour in a Fiat 500 talking about girls not fancying me as much as I fancy them. You know, there is room for everyone, and it's important to also celebrate that.
Is there room on that highway for Rita Ora?
I think there is room for Rita Ora. I think she can rehabilitate herself after this.
In her Chevy 68.
Yeah, in her boo. Well, I think if she takes anything from this experience, it's that people wanted a more authentic statement from her, and that people are craving more authentic statements from all of our pop stars. It's a, you know, a tumultuous time. And when we're listening to our music, I think we are looking for perhaps a bit more meaning than we might have been a couple of years ago when we were blissfully singing along to Katy Perry, not thinking about the world ending. I'd like to thank my guests, Shura, over there in London, Mackenzie, and Wesley. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, any place where you get your audio. Our producer is Pedro Rosado of Headstepper Media. John Caramonica is our regular host. I am just sitting in. And thank you. We'll see you next week.